go ahead and call the Trade Technology and Innovation Committee to order. Present for the record are Senators Stevens, Willikowski, and myself, McGuire. And we have today on the agenda an overview of some of the technological advances in neurosurgery. And we're excited today to have Christy Ortuso, the Director of Neuroscience Services at Providence Alaska Medical Services, here to talk with us. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairwoman McGuire, committee members. I'm happy to be here today. My name is Christy Ortuso. I am the Director of Neuroscience Services at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Neuroscience Services was created a little over a year ago to look at the needs of Alaskans with specific neurologic disorders. And at that time, I began to look at the opportunity to use technology to deliver specific aspects of care. And so I'm here today to share some of the innovations that we've now begun to implement in the state of Alaska that have not been here very long, but that will make a difference not only in how our patients access care, but also will make a difference in how the patients survive some of the devastating illnesses and injuries that are associated with neurologic disorders. So I want to talk about the quality aspects in delivering care through technology. As you all know, technology continues to advance and facilitate improved quality in the delivery of health care in a dynamic and complex environment. Our health care system has changed at a very rapid rate over the past 5, 10, 15, even 20 years. And we are delivering care through a different model today than we did 30 years ago. We have to think very differently, and we need to use the tools that are available to us and the day-to-day innovations that allow us to meet the needs of our patients at a much higher level than we had in the past. So, how does technology itself impact the healthcare system? Well, we're using it every day. One thing that has happened is that we're using electronic medical records in many of our healthcare organizations. Now you ask yourself, well, why would that make such a great difference? Well, it provides accessibility to that medical information for the patient globally. We live in a society where patients travel and individuals travel. Imagine how comfortable it would be if you were traveling to the state of California or New York, and the doctor that had to see you in an emergency room because of an unexpected illness or injury could access your complete medical history from Alaska. Eventually, electronic medical records will allow us to access information globally on all patients. And we're very cautious about protecting the patient's information as well. Computer chip-based clinical monitoring devices. These are devices that are in use in some areas that actually use computer chips to monitor some conditions that patients have. Did you know that we actually have a computer chip that you can swallow that contains a camera that looks at the inside of the intestine? And eventually it will exit. But it will give us pictures along the way. Sorry for the graphic picture. But
I think everyone's happy there. I think
and on that note, Senator French has joined us.
But we do use computer chip.
The end note.
Medical devices and monitoring devices to, again, deliver care at a different level. Other technologies include web-based tech applications that I'm going to talk about today, where we use wireless connectivity to either see a patient, to evaluate a patient, to share information, or to provide a service that we couldn't otherwise provide. We also use clinical decision support software, and those two programs that I'm going to talk about today are the IMPACT program and the electronic ICU, or the EICU. This software allows us to make decisions at a much higher level, much more rapidly, and to also improve the quality of patient care delivery by recognizing issues and problems much earlier than we would in a traditional model. We're talking about a clinical transformation. The concept of clinical transformation is developed with new models of care being delivered. We're not able to support care the traditional way anymore. We need to look at technology to support our ability to deliver care. Hospitals with multi-million dollar information systems and hospitals with no computer systems are now beginning to compete with each other. Hospitals with no computer systems are being forced into the world of technology because they're not able to deliver the care. So it's no longer just an option, it's something that we all have to do. The technology in itself will maximize the clinician's time in clinical care. In other words, we use technology to improve the access that we have with our patients, not to replace us, but to improve our ability to provide patient care. It's user-friendly. Many of the technologies that we're using are very, very simple. In fact, in one device that I've tested and used, we gave it to a 5-year-old with no instructions and said, let's just see how they do. They knew to turn it on because most of them come and operate a DVD player. Right. And at that point, that particular device spoke the instructions. And so the 5-year-old was able to manipulate the device and follow the instructions. So we are creating devices that are very user-friendly. These devices are shown to impact patient safety, produce better outcomes, and I'm going to show you why that's an important concept for legislators to be aware of. And it also meets the goals of the organization's strategic and business needs, which are also important. Because in order to deliver high-quality health care, we have to have a strategic direction and a business plan that is sustainable. Because if we're not sustainable, then we will no longer be able to meet the needs of the patients in the state of Alaska. Clinical alarms that are actually built into these programs will warn caregivers of immediate or potential adverse patient conditions. In other words, not just the simple electrocardiogram where you can see the patient's heart rate and it tells you that the heart rate's getting lower, but how about a machine that tells me that the patient's pressure on the inside of their brain is increasing, but ever so slightly, over 2, 4, 6, or 8 hours. But I can begin to see that trend. Now, if I'm only going into that patient's room once every hour, once every half hour, which is a lot, I may not see the trend. But if I'm sitting in front of a computer that's trending it for me, that computer is telling me there's something you need to look at. It also takes that information and includes the patient's vital signs, their heart rate and their blood pressure, and lets me know about a potential difficult situation that otherwise would not be apparent. So these types of programs provide additional alerts that are interpreted and acted on by the clinicians at the bedside appropriately. So we're going to talk about three programs that are all here in the state of Alaska. We have the IMPACT program that we use for patients with a traumatic brain injury. Now that brain injury may be a brain injury from an accident, or it could be what we call an acquired brain injury from a stroke, but a patient with a cognitive deficit. So that's the inability to think clearly. We're going to talk about the telestroke program that we're going to be launching in the next 2 weeks. We're currently installed in several locations. We're testing the information technology. We even have one cart down here in Juneau. So we should share that with everyone that's working here. It's very exciting. So we're going to be connecting patients in Juneau with Anchorage to provide a higher level of care that has never been available in Alaska. And on January 27th, we launched an EICU, which is a totally computerized intensive care unit that uses clinical software decision support to monitor all the patients in an intensive care unit by a nurse and an intensivist. So it allows those individuals to use the software to recognize before they would be clinically apparent a problem that's potentially brewing with a patient and alert the practitioner at the bedside to take action earlier to minimize those complications. So let's talk about IMPACT for just a few minutes. So what is a concussion? Well, we've learned a lot about concussions. How many of you remember years ago when you'd fall down or a football player and they'd say, get back on the field, you'll be fine. Go ahead and hit the guy that hit you. Hit him harder. We waited to see if they got up. As soon as they got up, everyone applauded and said, back in the game. Get back on the horse. I grew up with that one. Well, the reality is that may not have been the best choice, and we know more today than we knew back then. A concussion is a disturbance in brain function that occurs either after a blow in the head to the head as a result or as the result of violent shaking. So an impact with a motor vehicle can cause a concussion as well. Believe it or not, the annual incidence of sports-related concussions is over 300,000. That is almost half of the number of people that have strokes every year. Statistics estimate that over 20% of all athletes are likely to sustain a concussion every season. Every sports season, that's significant, 1 in 5. post-concussion syndrome is actually something that happens over a longer period of time. We have patients that have deficits that will last for 4, 6, 8, or 10 years after their initial injury, and yet they may not have been diagnosed with a brain injury at the time of the accident itself. These patients suffer things like chronic headaches, fatigue, sleep disturbances, personality changes, sensitivity to light or noise, dizziness when they stand up, or more importantly, deficits in their short-term memory, problem-solving, and academic functioning. Suffering a second blow when your cognitive function has not recovered can be catastrophic. There are several states in the United States that have had mortalities, deaths, after a second concussion or a third concussion when the first one has not healed. Unfortunately, they're diagnosed on autopsy. We don't want that to happen in Alaska, so we're really working diligently to raise the awareness of the significance of traumatic brain injury among Alaskans and the significance of these mild and moderate brain injuries. IMPACT is a program that we're using to diagnose and help us guide treatment. And we do need legislative support just to help us with the awareness and to help people understand how important it really is. So what do we recommend when we diagnose a concussion with this software? No adolescent with a concussion should continue to play or return to a game after sustaining a concussion. That's number one. And the second one is an individual sustaining a concussion should cease doing any activity that causes the symptoms of those concussion to increase, like headaches or dizziness or nausea, because that in itself will delay recovery. Let me tell you a brief story. My son suffered a concussion in January in Phoenix. He plays hockey. His coach came in, and the assistant coach came into the locker room. The assistant coach said, "Oh, I think he got hurt." The coach said, "He's fine. Let him go back out on the ice." So after a brief discussion, I said, "I don't think so." We were flying back to Alaska, and he underwent IMPACT screening on Monday. He scored in less than the first percentile, and I'll show you how we score this, on 3 out of 4 categories. And the neuropsychologist who evaluated him said, "Well, I want you to stay off of video games for about 2 weeks, only an hour a day." He wasn't really thrilled with that recommendation. But they also told him he didn't have to take quizzes and tests for 2 weeks and that he could nap during school. Those worked out really well for him.
Yes.
So over the next 2 weeks, he did everything he was told, with the exception of the video game part. 2 weeks later, came back in and was reevaluated with IMPACT testing. He aced the entire test except in one area. In his verbal memory and visual memory, he was worse than the week before. And the only variable were the video games. This time he was really upset because it was another week off the ice. So he decided to follow the instructions and not do anything he was told not to. A week later, he scored in the 80th and 90th percentile on everything. We really were able to show a significant improvement. But we have other students, other individuals, who go through the testing and their teachers say to them, "That's ridiculous. They're fine." They don't want to support the fact that a physician or a medical neuropsychologist has said this cognitive failure will impact their ability to succeed in school, to succeed on a test. It impacts people's relationships, their ability to sustain work. So we need to be more aware of diagnosing these injuries and also what we can do to, in addition to that, to help them rebuild that function. We try to modify school attendance and activities, and we do neurocognitive testing through the IMPACT program. It's only one piece of the puzzle. We have to look at these individuals, look at their symptoms, look at their background, look at any underlying disorders that they might have. But IMPACT has been shown to be most effective as a tool to look at the significance of the injury, and it is a computer-based test that is portable. It can be done on a laptop. No athlete should ever return to contact or competitive sports until they are completely symptom-free, both at rest and at exercise. And when we test them before we clear them, we test them with exercise as well. We've had patients, as I said before, where their post-concussive syndrome lasts more than a month. And most significantly, they have concentration and memory issues. We've also had another young man who's 15 years old who was a part of our program this year who became clinically depressed after 4 months and it was really related to this, again, a mild traumatic brain injury, had no other clinical signs or symptoms. So this is bridging a gap in our care delivery system that has never been bridged before. Because historically, if you came in and we did a CAT scan and everything looked fine, we would send you home and say, get some rest for a day or so and you'll be better. What we know now is that's really not true. And by not allowing those brain cells to heal, we're actually harming the individual. So what is it? It's a user-friendly, Windows-based computer program that can be administered by a team coach, an athletic trainer, a physician, or we use neuropsychologists and their team to administer the program. It has 10 modules in it. It allows us to assess an individual as they fatigue, so we can put them at exercise and see how they do with exercise, and it takes 20 minutes. Relatively inexpensive as well. What does it measure? It measures their attention span, their working memory, their sustained and selective attention time. It measures variability in their response. It measures their nonverbal problem solving, how they solve a problem with colors, with numbers, with shapes, etc., and their reaction time. And it has been validated across the country by varying age groups as well as varying types of individuals. So they've looked at all of the data, different kinds of people, male, female, age groups, athlete, non-athlete, etc., and we've validated its accuracy. So what do we look at? We do word discrimination, which measures attention. We do design memory, put pictures up in front of them and allow them to tell us what they were. X's and O's measures a working memory as well as visual processing. Symbol matching, color matching, and something called three letters, which measures working memory and visual motor response speed. We've also been told that it's not possible to cheat. It's also not possible to prepare yourself to pass it the next time. And the children and the athletes that I've tested this year have all said the same thing. Even the one that's been through it, I think Jonathan's been through it now, the one young man for 4 months, about 10 or 12 times. He says it's not possible to remember how to respond to the questions because of the way it's structured. It's a very reliable test. It measures symptoms. We actually enter other data about how they're feeling. Do they have headaches? Are they dizzy at all? Do their eyes hurt for them? Do they have trouble seeing certain colors? So it measures other components, and the computer program itself puts all this information together for us. This can help athletic trainers, school officials, as well as physicians make very difficult decisions. One of the pediatricians called me a few months ago and said, you know, we need to treat the whole person. Jonathan's really, really traumatized over this. I want to let him go back out on the ice. I said, I don't think that's a good idea. And sure enough, the parents decided to let him go back out for a little while. He regressed significantly over the next 2 weeks and actually developed more significant memory problems, dizziness, headaches, clumsiness. So they did see the impact of sending him back out too early, and now he was just cleared 2 weeks ago, so he's doing very, very well. But the reality is we never had these programs available to us before. So who uses it? The National Football League, Major League Baseball, Professional Automobile Racing, the National Basketball Association, Olympic organizations, all NHL teams. Now, I find that amazing because not one of our junior hockey leagues in the state of Alaska has embraced this.
Interesting.
The Alaska Aces uses it, but not our junior teams or our school systems. Rugby, junior soccer, many colleges and universities, none in Alaska. High schools throughout the United States, none in Alaska. The Alyeska Ski and Snowboard Club, however, uses it. They screen their athletes beforehand, 20 minutes, we can do it on a laptop for the whole team, takes an afternoon, get a baseline, and then if they suffer any injuries, it shows us how severe that injury is. If we don't have the baseline, we still use the test, but we have to score it against the approximate norms in the country. So it's not quite as definitive for an individual, and what we usually do is we make our decisions on the conservative side. If I don't have a baseline on an athlete, I'm going to make that decision based on what most children or athletes at that age across the country would perform at. So it's not specific to the person. So, who can tell me what visual you see on the screen? Do you know what that is?
Mm-mm.
Ah, it's actually an air traffic control unit.
Oh.
The electronic ICU, the EICU, is a system-wide critical care program built on technology very similar to an air traffic control unit. And we use that as a visual to show you what this program looks like on a little bit of a smaller scale, although some air traffic control towers are rather small. It provides technology, infrastructure that actually impacts quality, operating efficiency, and economic performance. The EICU program is staffed with an intensivist, that's a physician who is board certified as an intensive care physician, and critical care nurses with years of experience with certifications as experts at a computerized monitoring station that allows them to monitor hundreds of patients just like air traffic controllers monitor hundreds of airplanes in the sky. An EICU facility actually keeps patients safe. That's what they're there for. One nurse can monitor up to about 50 patients. One physician can monitor up to about 50 patients. There are a few EICUs in the United States where they go above that. What we've heard from most of the practitioners is that 50 is a very comfortable number. They're very bored at 20 or 30, believe it or not. So this is what an EICU looks like in a big, you have a big city hospital or a tertiary care center that has all the services, and that EICU connects them with community hospitals or rural hospitals and allows your critical care practitioners and your intensivists to help the rural or community hospitals deliver a higher level of care by providing guidance in decision making. This is an actual picture of the EICU using computer support technology. As you can see in the middle of the screen where her finger is up above, all the patients are listed. You can see red bars, yellow bars. Those bars indicate various alerts. On the right-hand side, the practitioner can actually pull up all of the patient's vital signs, their heart rate, their blood pressures, all of their interactive information, the electronic medical record, and at the same time, they can pull up imaging studies, chest x-rays, brain CAT scans, and they can take all that information from one desktop and combine it to get a full picture of the patient. Where it gets even more fun is that we have cameras in every room, and so the nurse can video in and see the patient, talk to the nurse in the room, speak with the physicians that are live in the room, and make recommendations, as well as the intensivist. They can do the same thing. The lab tests are actually automatically fed into the system so that they get all the lab results, all the reports from diagnostic studies, to one location. And so we're able to help people make decisions for clinical care in that mechanism. So why do we want to use technology to deliver critical care? We've been doing it very well for many years. Healthcare has safety and quality problems because we rely on outdated systems of work. We need safer, higher quality care, so therefore we will have to redesign the systems that we use. You may never have heard of the LeapFrog Group, but I was very much aware of them because in the Northeast they drove our decisions. LeapFrog was a group of individuals from big businesses, large corporations that paid a great deal of money for health insurance plans.
Huh.
And what they said was, they have an awesome website, leapfrog.org. What they said was, if we're going to pay all this money for health care for our employees, then we want to make sure that that care is being delivered at a certain standard. We believe that our employees deserve the best care delivered by evidence-based or research-based standards, and we want to see proof that every hospital that we recognize as a preferred provider does deliver that care. LeapFrog created such standards that hospitals in the Northeast were required to submit monthly reports on the quality data.
Wow.
If we fell below the national average, they could take us off of their preferred provider list. That might mean for a hospital business that you might not have 20 or 30,000 eligible patients from a Merrill Lynch or
Christy,
a large.
Yes. And I'm just going to let you know because we have 15 minutes left.
Okay.
Members have commitments. So what I was just looking at this, I was going to see if you could, you know, skip through to basically what the technology is and where it's being used in Alaska, where you think it could be used.
Sure.
If expanded, and then so that we can get into the final part of your.
Just, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
So we have the EICU in place at Providence in Anchorage. It currently is monitoring the 30 ICU beds that we have. We have not rolled it out to other facilities yet.
Okay.
There is a cost involved to us. We lease the program from VisiQ. It's a patented program, and it is the only one available. I think a key component to remember is that there there is a potential in the near future for Medicare to require intensivist presence in an intensive care unit.
Oh.
And this would bridge that gap. If Medicare eventually requires that for quality reasons, then we would not have enough intensivists to staff the intensive care units in the state of Alaska. So I think that's a key takeaway from this presentation, is that it does bridge that gap. It's been wired, it exists, and it works. We have telestroke in existence now. We have now put, and I will go, you can read the statistics about stroke. You all know it's bad, and it costs us a lot of money. So we all agree with that. The biggest reason that we have a problem with stroke care, not only in Alaska but across the country, is lack of neurologic expertise in rural hospitals.
Okay.
Not just a neurologist, but a stroke neurologist. We have the first stroke neurologist in the state of Alaska as of September of 2008.
Wow.
Okay, so we never had one before. Now we have one. He's in Anchorage. He's my director of this program. And so what we've done is we have developed and implemented a telestroke system where we're using, and I'll skip through these because you have all those statistics, where we're using this system, using a webcam with a basic simple computer on wheels, and on the left is the neurologist's personal laptop. I could pull my laptop up right now and log into that cart and do a patient consult from this room if you have wireless internet, which you do in the hallway, so it would work for me. I can go anywhere, including Alyeska Ski Resort, I tested that 2 weeks ago, and log in and do a patient consult so I can see the patient. That cart allows me to see the patient, interact and talk to the patient, evaluate the severity of their stroke, and look at the CAT scan and the diagnostic tests that we get for the patient with a stroke and make a decision about how to treat them. Strokes can only be treated effectively within 3 hours of the onset of symptoms, for the most part. In order to give the medication that is available to be given, we have to do that within 3 hours. Now, we have two additional procedures that we can do in Anchorage only, and that's intra-arterial medication to dissolve the clot that's in the brain, or we actually have a clot retrieval device that looks like a corkscrew. We put it right into the vascular system of the brain and we pull the clot out. We can do that within 6 hours of the onset of symptoms. But what happens if the patient is here in Juneau? How can we possibly do that without getting the neurologist's eyes on that patient in Juneau? So this allows us to get his eyes on the patient, make a decision, have our team ready, and have a jet lift off to take that patient to Anchorage. It's not possible to fly to Seattle in that amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So we really worked with Bartlett to develop a collaborative relationship where we could have those patients brought up to Anchorage so we could do what was right for the patients in Alaska. Currently, and I know I'm getting to the, there we go. I put a cart in Juneau. We have one in Kodiak. We have one in Seward. And we have a cart in Anchorage as well. We also have a cart going into Valdez and one in Soldotna. Within the next 3 weeks, they'll be installed and live. I really would like to put a cart out in the Matsu Valley to facilitate improved care for patients with stroke from the Valley and in Fairbanks. So I'm working diligently to try to put telemedicine carts in those areas to try to improve the quality of care for patients in those areas. And then in the future, we'd like to put carts up in potentially in Bethel as well as in, I know Sitka's interested and so is Homer. So we'd like to put carts in different areas. Now you have telemedicine out in the villages, but you don't have all the technologies that are required to treat stroke patients. But if we get these carts in areas that have those technologies that we need in place, the CAT scan with the DICOM images that can be uploaded, as well as a licensed provider where they can give the medication, then we have also placed ambulances in strategic locations to move those patients to where they can get the higher level of care much, much quicker. So the benefits is the physician's mobile. He can go anywhere. He can sit in his living room. He can be skiing if he can get down the mountain in 7 minutes, which he assures me he can.
Mm-hmm.
We can be at Taco Bell, McDonald's, anywhere with a laptop and log on and do a consult. See the patient, make a decision, help them deliver the right type of care to that patient, and then determine whether we need to do advanced therapies like a clot retrieval or intra-arterial retrievals. So there are benefits to it. It works over the web. There's no hardware to break down. We have a service out in Augusta, Georgia that is actually supplying us, and we've now tested it in several locations. So we're confident that it's going to be successful in the state of Alaska. We based all of our decisions in bringing this technology up based on the patients in Alaska, their needs, and the outcomes. Alaska has one of the worst stroke death rates in the United States, and we intend to improve that death rate and even surpass other cities and states through the use of a Reach teleconsult. Okay, so where are we at now? We're doing public awareness campaigns. We've got some media coverage coming up. We have collaborative initiatives. We're trying to develop strategic partnerships with hospitals and corporations throughout the state to deliver this level of care to the patients and the people of the state of Alaska, because they deserve that access. This addresses one of the major national health care goals, and that's access to quality health provision. And so we can bridge that access through an electronic ICU, through a telestroke or telemedicine system, as well as through impact screening, where we can actually move that screening out to the patients.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Arturso, questions?
Just an excellent presentation. Really, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate it. And you've got a good mix of the Senate here that will pass along the interesting information you've given us today. And it's exciting. Technology is so important. And to a place like our state, it might be the only way that we get some of these healthcare delivery systems. Senator Frent?
Just another comment. It's a point I made recently, which is it's yet another argument for webcams, because it's a great presentation. It could be shared more, you know, statewide. If we were able to stream your presentation to the public at large as you're making it to us.
And that is actually what we're doing with our public education. In fact, in 2 weeks, we have Dr. Lotta, who is our only stroke neurologist, who is going to be doing a presentation, and we're going to stream it to 5 different hospitals live.
That's great.
And so we're doing the same thing and trying to get this information out to practitioners and to help them understand that, I know you thought you were doing a good job, but we're going to help you do better.
Yeah.
So we can impact the outcomes.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much. We're adjourned.